With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Issa Blumey is back with me today. Issa is an associate professor in the Department of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at Stockholm University. He is a historian and he is the author of several books, most recently Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. Today he joins me from Budapest. Issa, how are you, my friend?
It's wonderful to hear your voice, Jesse, and good evening to your audience. I'm fine, thank you.
Last week, you and I, toward the end of our conversation, started to talk about the rebranding of Saudi Arabia that's been going on in the wake of its reestablishing diplomatic ties with Iran, a reestablishment that was mediated by China and is largely being hailed as a win for the so-called emerging multipolar world order. And this rebranding has involved a lot of revisionism, particularly with regard to the war on Yemen. I want to get to that, but before we do, I want to talk about Saudi's financials and its productivity, particularly with regard to oil, because as Bloomberg published on March 12th, Saudi Aramco posts blowout annual profit and raises dividend. The firm made a net income of $161 billion, and its fourth quarter dividend went up to $19.5 billion. But when you look at a Bloomberg article published today, there is a chart of the week which shows that Saudi Arabia recently imported millions of barrels of diesel from Russia, despite being the world's top crude exporter. The kingdom imported almost 2.5 million barrels of diesel-type fuel from Russia in the first 10 days of March. While that's far smaller than the country's daily diesel needs, and Saudi Arabia has for years bought fuel products from other countries when its refineries undergo maintenance, it's more than at any other time in the last 6 years, according to Kepler data compiled by Bloomberg. And there are many other things that don't compute that we can get into when we look at Saudi's financials and its productivity and its capacity for productivity, particularly with regard to oil. But to start with what the example I just gave, let's go from there and get your assessment on what's happening here.
Right. A couple of things. Going back to the 1970s, the kind of deal with the devil where from Nixon's surprise of separating the U.S. dollar from gold to finding an alternative in which the rest of the world would have to accumulate, otherwise the rapidly depreciating value of dollars, so dollars that were losing their value, gained new let's say value in the case that it was the exclusive currency to be used to buy especially oil, but other commodities as well. So kind of the petrol dollar dynamic, which still exists till today. And even those who are now seeing a multipolar world out there, they still acknowledge that until even China moves away from buying its oil for U.S. dollars, it's going to accumulate U.S. dollars. And that's one aspect that Saudi Arabia has been at the forefront of, promoting that relationship with empire. That empire's chosen medium of of exchange for goods and services, the dollar, in which it produces endless amounts, especially in the last 10 or so years. And we're going to see only a ratcheting up of the printing of money, so to speak, moving forward with these bank collapses and how that's going to translate. And we can talk about that in a second. So that's the very kind of structural rationale for Saudi Arabia to be heralded and celebrated since the 70s by, unfortunately, academia, as well as trade interests from industry to, let's say, economic journalists. Well, that's their main mandate, is to market this idea that Saudi Arabia and OPEC are market makers. And they do that because they're the primary providers of subsidized fuel for the rest of the world. But more importantly, that they're going to recirculate any money that's paid for that fuel, the dollars, back into Western economies by way of investments, by way of propping up property markets, buying football teams, you know, in many ways that so-called Saudi money, which in reality is actually buying arms. But in reality, it's not cash, it's credit. They're borrowing money. And this is, there's an important element to, they're able to, when they market themselves in certain ways, that it's a boom economy, that Mohammed bin Salman, over the last couple of years, is pushing Saudi Arabia towards change. He's revitalized Saudi Arabia's position in the regional economy, completely obliterating the role that Saudi Arabia has been playing in destroying neighboring countries, whether it be Syria, Iraq, Libya, and of course Yemen. The marketing of Mohammed bin Salman, the marketing of Saudi Arabia as a duplication, a repeat, an improvement of the Dubai model, moving forward, is something that there's a vested interest in promoting that. And this most recent period of propping up, pumping up the Saudi case for money to be circulating into the Saudi economy, is a very corrupt one. And there's no better example of that than the pumping up of the actual numbers of what Saudi Arabia, in theory, is producing daily, on a daily basis, to help balance the global trade in oil. That Saudi's role as market maker means that it balances and can provide excess capacity to help make sure that oil prices and the demand for oil doesn't go beyond the means of Western economies or dependent economies to pay for it. At the same time, Saudi Arabia is a major accumulator of excess wealth, savings, so to speak, and therefore can serve the role that Silicon Valley Bank until recently served, which is just throw their money into B-rated debt of the West, or throw their money into these stock markets, or in the case of Credit Suisse, supposedly the Saudi National Bank put huge amounts of savings, which again, is not real cash, it's on their accounts, but it's borrowed money. So this is a huge Ponzi scheme that is increasingly Saudi Arabia has found itself trying to find creative ways of getting out of it, which has been one reason why Mohammed bin Salman presented himself to the larger world, and why certain actors in the larger world have presented him as such, to somehow maintain the idea that Saudi Arabia is a good place to park your money. So when F1 Formula One races, or when some new golf league, or when the most famous football player comes and becomes the employee of some Saudi enterprise, these are all good marketing ploys, or at least this is what they think. But the smart money is, you never go to Saudi Arabia and dump your money there. They're having the hardest time to adjust their economy to actually be the major hub for regional trade. Example, they demand now any company that gets contracts with the Saudi government has to move their headquarters to Riyadh. Unfortunately, they have realized that there are actually very few takers in that they are actually not in a position, they don't have the leverage to actually demand that of major corporations to move their headquarters to Riyadh, because frankly, no one wants to live in Riyadh. And so that's a very interesting example of the kind of games that Saudi Arabia is trying to play. It has imposed a VAT on its citizens. It's trying to force its citizens to participate in the Saudi economy in a much more direct way as labor, but also as to throw their savings, no longer to repatriate Saudi money into the Saudi economy. And this whole Aramco story is a perfect example of that. Aramco was a Saudi-owned company. It's been trying to issue IPOs, which means that it's trying to offer a percentage of ownership of Aramco, which again used to be exclusively owned by American conglomerates until Saudi Arabia was forced to buy at huge price increases this stake, if you will, a state-held stake in Aramco in the 1970s. People forget about that. Huge transfer of wealth in that period. But yet again, Saudi Arabia was trying to create a buzz about Aramco, that it's an oil company that has endless access to huge oil supplies in Saudi Arabia, that it's a major market maker, that there's plenty of opportunity to borrow money off of Aramco's assets. But in the meantime, in the kind of second paragraph of all these celebratory articles that come from Financial Times or Bloomberg, is that they're desperately trying to find investors in the IPO issuance. And for many years, they just could not actually, they've actually retracted their issuance of their IPO. It was only last year that Aramco was actually available. Certain amount of shares was available in the market. And in that case, they actually forced pension funds inside Saudi Arabia to actually buy the stocks. So Saudi Arabia has actually been forcing its own subjects to invest in and basically relocate their savings into Saudi national economy. And in the meantime, it's giving itself, Aramco is issuing a huge reward for shareholders. But of course, those who hold special shares, which is something that I don't know if your audience is aware of, that there was this recent report that Aramco had incredible profit and raises its dividend. It's issuing a dividend of $19.5 billion, supposedly, on the basis that it made a net income of $160 billion over a very blurry, undefined period of time when prices of oil was momentarily at $130 a barrel. I think a lot of that money, it's again funky accounting, but a lot of that money was probably with the IPO when money started flowing into its coffers when it sold shares to these various Saudi investment firms and pension funds that were forced to buy Aramco shares. And now, because it's a Ponzi scheme, Aramco's dividends is going back directly into the state coffers, this 4% dividend that's going in. So it's not going into individual investors or to the pension funds, but it's going to basically maintain some kind of liquidity for a country that has to import diesel, because it's desperately trying to maintain a certain kind of production level, which it claims it has plenty of excess capacity to produce more oil if necessary. But as I demonstrated in my book, one of the rationales of capturing some of Yemen's oil productivity or potential for oil productivity is that it could actually help shore up Aramco's, let's say, long-term capacity to actually produce, maintain a production level of 8 million, 9 million, if they're lucky, barrels a day. Mm-hmm. When they go up to 10.5 million barrels a day, they're importing oil from elsewhere. They're playing this kind of dubious game, which again, they're absorbing the cost. They're subsidizing in order to maintain this impression that Saudi Arabia is exporting and contributing 10.5 million barrels a day to the global market, which they're not. They've imported a lot of oil from Iraq. They borrowed a lot of excess oil production from Kuwait. And as we see with what you mentioned, they're actually importing refined diesel from Russia, because they need refined diesel to be imported in order to provide for their own domestic consumption, while whatever excess diesel they are producing goes out in the official terms as exports to the global markets. So there's a lot of shenanigans going on. The corruption that extends from the media to the rating agencies, which we've seen rating agencies did nothing to warn investors about Silicon Valley Bank or Credit Suisse. Definitely not.
Moody's downgraded, I believe it was, I'll have to double check. It was either SVB or Signature or Silvergate, one of those three. It did downgrade one of those very shortly before one of those three collapsed. And that seems to be a strategic downgrading, a targeted downgrading. I'll have to, again, double check which of those three it was, but your point is correct that while we have a report coming from Moody's itself that Moody's changes Saudi Arabia's outlook to positive affirms A1 ratings, Moody's is essentially silent except for the targeted situation I just mentioned on banks like Credit Suisse and others. First Republic, I believe nothing was said about First Republic, which is in crisis right now. So in that, we can see the shenanigans you talked about, not just on a regional level, but on a global level as well. Moody's is a French-based investors service, as it brands itself. So these are global shenanigans we're talking about. You mentioned go ahead.
Yeah, these are all important for borrowing money. For Saudi enterprises, the Saudi National Bank to borrow money to issue bonds, they need relatively high ratings. And, you know, for a while, they were all rated B, and they were paying 6-7% above LIBOR. It was a disaster that, over the last couple of months, they've been able to position themselves, and who knows how much money was entered in illicit ways to Moody's and others who probably had some kind of leverage over, you know, we can make or break, you know, and it could cost you $20-30 billion easily every year if you can't borrow money at certain rates. So that's very corrupted on that side. But the very fact that Moody's in their reports, you know, are applauding Saudi's diversification claim campaigns, which is all nonsense, by the way, the fact that they disguise the costs of war, the fact that they disguise the volatility of the oil markets, which is now down at $73 a barrel and dropping very quickly, that's under production cost. That means Saudi Arabia is losing money for every barrel it supposedly produces, let alone that it imports from Russia or from India or from Israel, from Spain. All these kinds of shell games that are played, and everybody in the markets know this. You are not going to get my money, the bonds holders are saying, to Saudi Arabia, unless you're going to give us a huge reward for it. I mean, the very fact that the Saudi National Bank, which is owned 37% by the Saudi Sovereign Fund, which is supposedly impervious because it's so wealthy, it's impervious to the ebbs and flows of the global financial market, which is nonsense. They just lost $1 billion when UBS made an agreement with Credit Suisse, with the backing of the Swiss National Bank. They lost about $1 billion within 24 hours. And they were desperately trying to get rid of their Credit Suisse. No one was going to buy because everybody knew that Credit Suisse is going to have to get a huge haircut in terms of valuation of its what remains of its value. And it was basically bought for $3 billion by UBS. And the ones who were basically left with their hands empty
after an infusion from the Swiss National Bank.
Exactly. And the ones who were left empty-handed were those schmoes from the Gulf who borrowed money to invest in what was convinced was a good way to manage your accounts and make some money for the Saudi sovereign fund. Where this is, again, the role of Saudi Arabia is to help provide liquidity for empires' enclaves in the Atlantic world, North Atlantic world. And who's going to pay for that $1 billion that was lost? How are they going to find that? Because they've borrowed that money. They're going to have to pay it back. And so all these shenanigans about the politics of China entering into the fray, this is all cover for, first of all, Saudi Arabia for years now has been issuing a fire sale. It's trying to create value to its assets and then somehow find people to invest in it. From its property, they want to develop an idea that you should invest in these new cities that they envision, which again are just completely produced by computer models now. They don't exist. The existing cities are a complete mess. No one wants to invest in these new neighborhoods that they're promoting the last 2 or 3 weeks in Riyadh, let alone the very fact that they're in this struggle, this regional struggle over whatever remains of global capital with their rivals, Qatar and UAE. And it's quite astonishing to have even Mayadeen, which increasingly demonstrates to me that the decision for editorial decisions for these kinds of stories are really much determined by strategic calculations made beyond the actual editorial, say, core of these alternative media in the Middle East, whether it be the Cradle or Mayadeen. The fact that they're promoting this Iran-Saudi deal, that this is something that's creating kind of infrastructure and architecture for a new world order in which there will be a revitalization of the region. It's just kind of doing the same thing that Financial Times or Bloomberg do, but from a different perspective, that's marketing Iran as a survivor, that it's actually it's once again a relevant player. But in the meantime, it has not done anything to resolve the fundamental structural problems of the Gulf, which includes Iran. Iran has been bought for cheap by Chinese investors, which is an extension of empire. So Iran supposedly had a revolution to struggle against the inequities of global capitalism and pushed off the Americans, which was a legitimate revolution. And it's ended up becoming basically co-opted by the Chinese wing of empire or the Russian wing of empire. And this is all very, very depressing for those who have been sacrificing their lives for 30 years, both in Iran and in neighboring countries that have embraced this idea of perpetual rebellion against global capitalism and its empire. And Yemenis have made it very clear in the last couple of days that whatever Iran claims and says, and whatever the UN is arguing that Iran has an important role to help resolve the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, that Iran does not speak for us. And Tehran has actually had to revise its public statements and acknowledge that, yes, we have the portfolio in Yemen has nothing to do with us. It's an issue for Yemenis to resolve. On that regard, it's just incredible to see even the, most heralded alternative media from the Middle East being co-opted to service a narrative that the resistance on the ground refuses to accept. We do not trust these regimes that are supposedly now being rehabilitated. And why are you claiming that somehow?
And if I can just interject there, it goes further than that. And the narrative I've heard over the last several days is that this is a reaffirmation of the strength of the resistance axis, this rekindling of diplomatic relations between Iran and Saudi, and also that in this rekindling, Iran is not going to turn its back by any means on the people of Yemen. And these are statements that are made without evidence and seem to be made because the people who are making them desperately, for whatever reason or reasons, want to believe that there is a sea change underfoot, a multipolar sea change, when what we're witnessing, what's happening, is a rearrangement of empire, of global empire, of globalist empire. That's what we're seeing. We're not seeing anything revolutionary or potentially revolutionary, as a recent Al-Mayadeen piece put it, it's a rearrangement of the old order into something nominally new that is going to continue much along the same lines as the old order, although there will be changes, but those changes will be in service of a continued globalist empire. And it's so obvious to me, to you, and I think to a lot of other people that that's the case, but nonetheless, this other narrative persists, and it's not only persisting, it's getting ratcheted up to the point of historical revisionism, and people like the commentator Martin Jay, who's based in Morocco, saying on RT that there isn't one Chinese frigate off the Arabian coast, which is a complete lie, but pointing to that as, look, China is not a hegemon. China has no interest in colonizing. China is just about win-win cooperation. This is utter nonsense. And at the same time, he's on a panel with a representative of Saudi who's saying, look, we're not done doing business with the US. In fact, we just purchased several dozen Boeing jetliners from the US as an example, and we're going to keep being bedfellows with the US. So in a sense, he was trying to temper this very sanguine narrative that's, again, not just persisting, but growing in its absurdity. So it's so important to point this out because it has so many implications in terms of, as I said, the perpetuation of empire and also the continued war on actual resistance, like the people of Yemen, and the whitewashing of the history of what's gone on there, and who are the main drivers of that war and what their real motives are. It's getting obscured and whitewashed very quickly, and this is unacceptable.
Jesse, you got it. And this is what I'm concerned about. And this is something that I've already saw with Biden and even the late Trump when they were first positioning Ansar Allah as a terrorist organization. And that's Biden comes in and says, we're going to end the war in Yemen. We're just going to supply Saudi Arabia with defensive weapons and in UAE. That they are responsible in some, in many cases for this war. Of course, they left out key components, but they also were, I think, this is what my concern was. They were basically putting Ansar Allah and the resistance into a corner. And they were going to basically put them in a situation where they would have to actually reach the demands of the outside world before they could actually be rehabilitated. There was a ceasefire that ended a couple of months ago, but there were no positive results from that. There were no opening up of airspace. There was not the opening up of northern Yemen to the global to the larger world. That they still have to deal with an embargo. They still have to deal with day-to-day bombing and killings and assassinations. There are still attacks every day on Ansar Allah from Saudi Arabia, from drones. And then the mess in larger Yemen, it still continues with the competition between UAE, Qatari, and Saudi assets that actually now are dragging in American troops, who, by the way, are there. They're very openly now in bases. Just 2 days ago, an American soldier was killed by the guard, the soldiers, the so-called giants who are associated with the UAE, who are supposedly providing protection for their base in the oil-rich area of Shabwa, which was exactly where Ansar Allah was gaining ground when they were basically given an ultimatum that they had to sign the truce, otherwise the Americans would directly intervene. Because now, I'm afraid, with Iran playing along in this game, that they're going to all come to the basically the position that it's on on Sarah Law's table. It's the finding a solution is now really only exclusively at Ansar Allah's responsibility. And if there's not going to be peace, it's because the onus will be on Ansar Allah. The onus will be on those who are resisting in Lebanon. The onus will be on those who are resisting in Syria still. You see Bashar Assad, he's now in Abu Dhabi for the second time. They're heralding this as, you know, things are going to get better. Eastern Syria is not going to ever be returned to Damascus. It's going, the plunder of Syria's assets are going to continue in service the more powerful interests out there. So, you know, Syria seems to be capitulating and falling along these lines where the real resistance, the real manpower for resistance are going to be put in the corner where, and ultimately even Iran will blame Ansar Allah for not cooperating. Look, we have made the extra step. We have made agreements with our partners now across the Gulf, throughout Arabia. Even Bashar Assad has now come to terms with his former enemies. Why is there still resistance? And this is a very dubious, dangerous slide towards really no recourse for people who are still in resistance. And I think that this is something maybe some elements in Iran are going to begin to realize is very dangerous. And people in Syria and in larger Lebanon, in the context of the war against occupation of Palestine, they're going to have to start turning their weapons on what used to be their primary state supporters. And so this is something for us to be looking for in the future. And unfortunately, Russia has implemented itself in a theater that was otherwise very difficult for empire to control and mediate. And it was at much less cost when Putin sends Russian troops to basically now serve as they dictate basically, right? They haven't stopped Israeli air strikes.
Hello? No, and just to that point, the Jerusalem Post published a piece a few days ago titled "Netanyahu Weighs Defensive Military Aid to Ukraine." This is a story that's been bouncing around for quite some time now, but the biggest takeaway from this latest piece is the last paragraph. Israel has been under pressure from the United States and its Western allies to more fully align itself with Ukraine. Israel has feared angering Russia, whose military sits on its northern border with Syria. It needs to maintain its deconfliction agreement with Russia, which allows it to operate in Syrian airspace to attack Iranian military targets in that country. This is something you and I have talked about.
Yeah.
We've talked about this a number of times, but it's out in the open. Even RT articles have admitted this, but it's ignored or given an excuse by those who are now cheering on the developments between Iran and Saudi and China and Russia. And I still hear the excuse or explanation, I don't know what you call it at this point, that the anti-aircraft batteries in Syria are not being used. The S-300s are not being used. S-300s, which are mobile, to the best of my knowledge, so they can be fired and moved quite quickly. But they're not being used against these Israeli strikes because still Syria is waiting for when things get really hot with Israel to start using these anti-aircraft batteries. And this is a narrative that persists despite the almost daily bombings of Syria by Israel that we see now, including of major locations like Damascus Airport or recently the airport in Aleppo. As I've said before, I think it's hot enough now to start using these weapons, So why aren't they being used? And what does that have to do with this deconfliction agreement that Russia has with Israel? And is Russia's presence in Syria at this point beneficial to Syrians and Syrian resistance? And where does Assad sit in that equation? What's most important to him? We never hear from the Syrian people what they want in this. We always hear from Assad. We hear from Putin. We hear from all the people in that camp, and everything is a love fest and the multipolar world is rising. But still, these strikes, these killings, these anti-resistance actions continue.
And again, this will it already probably manifested in many occasions. There was lots of frustration in certain units with the relationship, the politics, if you will, of this war in Syria. And the same applies in other war zones throughout the region. Very quickly, loose coalitions and alliances that were basically reliant on the common enemy, if you will, can be upset. And this is certainly strategy. And what really kept the Iranian revolution and the Iranian people together for so many years was that they did ultimately understand what this was all about, why this sacrifice. And it's not clear when you have clearly corrupt elements influencing. And this is why CIA invested so heavily in alternative media in the Persian language sphere. They're the ones who have been pushing this outlandish lifestyle behavior of some sons of the elites inside Iranian Revolutionary Guard. I mean, the kind of expose of the playboy kind of lifestyle that certain actors inside the Syrian military and Syrian security services really has caused big dissension. This is one of the reasons why when there was an open call for revolt in 2011, many people who would have either just stayed on the sidelines, or many of them thought they were actually fighting for a real revolution to change a corrupt Ba'athist party regime. Well, we can argue whether or not this is historically true, but many were not Salafists, you know, Takfiri types. Many of them were pushed out by the momentum of this war that was instigated, no doubt, by CIA agents, and then they inserted this Islamic State element to really bring the dynamic of separating Syria, breaking Syria apart. Now, they weren't able to successfully defeat the entirety of large segments of Syrian society who saw they had no place to go. Their back was against the wall, and they embraced this common struggle to protect Syria, to protect Hezbollah, to protect the struggle in Palestine. But if they start seeing defections and corruption, and this is certainly happening with Iran too, I suspect that they are really teetering on a dangerous move now. The idea that you would embrace Saudi Arabia when all your brothers and sisters in Bahrain and Eastern Saudi Arabia who were murdered, who were beheaded, who are in prisons right now because they're Shia. The idea that you would actually shake hands with these assholes, these monsters, the destruction that Saudi Arabia on behalf of empire has brought to the Islamic world, brought to brothers and sisters throughout the third world, what they have done. I was just reviewing this long list of destruction of cultural heritage in Yemen. They literally targeted from day one to destroy museums, to destroy libraries, to destroy Yemen as a place, to destroy UNESCO sites. And they did it for a reason. They did this to Syria as well. They do this strategically. Mm-hmm. They did this to Iraq. And in the meantime, they plunder what's valuable so they can sell in the black markets. And these are evil people. And So you would actually embrace evil people is basically, why don't you just sign an agreement with Washington, for God's sake? Let's just cut playing games and just capitulate. And that would mean bullets in some people's heads who make these agreements, right? I mean, this is a dangerous game for these for the Raisi and these others. But they're going to do it through this medium of China and embracing this a multipolar world is going to be something that ideologically is going to be nuanced, and they're going to shape it to actually rationalize why this is happening. Not that we've capitulated, but they have capitulated. They're capitulating to empire through a different mechanism. But Iran's natural resources are going into the global markets. They're going to get below market value for their natural resources. There are going to be a few corrupt officials who get the lion's share of any of the wealth that's produced inside Iran. And the people who are going to be making money from Iran's natural resources are going to be in Hong Kong. They're going to be in the city of London, New York, and Zurich. Usual suspects. And the same applies with Mohammed bin Salman and all these games about transforming Saudi Arabia. Okay, maybe he as an individual and the small clique around him will survive. Maybe they will not. That's still to be determined. But they've basically transformed the whole narrative about Saudi Arabia in order to survive fiscally. And that's something that they're very precarious now, because the world is changing. And I can assure you, empire has no loyalty whatsoever. They will immediately see Mohammed bin Salman hanging from a lamppost if it serves their interest. And at this stage, it's using China and Russia to deal with the very messy business of this transition. There are still pockets of resistance in the former Soviet Union. China has been integrated into the global economy. Chinese people are being exploited as cheap labor, as a good place to park your resources and sell them crappy materials and a lifestyle. And now China is being used as an alternative to overt imperialism. But it's empire still. It's still imperialism. It's just mediated through someone who could be marketed as acceptable, because there once was a Maoist China that was resistant in the 1950s to empire. The same with Putin. Putin destroyed the Soviet Union along with Yeltsin. He was a selected successor to Yeltsin. He's the one who's been involved in all these nasty wars in the Caucasus and getting involved in Kazakh and Tajik wars and the wars in Middle East. And what has that produced? Divided Syria, a people of Yemen who have completely been abandoned, their natural resource being plundered for nothing, Libya completely destroyed, the most wealthy country in Africa that had a vision for Africa to really peel its way independently. What has Russia and China done to save that enterprise, to save that third way, if you will, that rebellious element that still existed in Africa? There's no rebellion in Africa. It's just now making money. Russian oil companies are now drilling offshore in Congo, along with the Belgian and the Austrian and the French companies. I mean, it's the same, same small clique of money makers.
Yeah. And the Italian company as well. Yeah. This was published on the 17th by oilprice.com. Russian oil company Lukoil snaps up offshore blocks in Congo. And this is an extension of a joint venture that Lukoil has been in with Eni for some years now. And it goes back to at least 2019, when Lukoil purchased a 25% stake in Marine 12, which is an energy block offshore of Congo, for $800 million. Eni, which holds a 65% stake in the project, signed a contract with China's Wison Heavy Industry to build an FLNG installation with a capacity of 2.4 million tons. So we have Russia here, we have Italy, we have China here, and this is what they're trying to sell to us as the development, in inverted commas, of Africa. And because it's not being done at the barrel of a gun yet, that it's somehow different than the colonization of European entities, the centuries of colonization by European entities.
Well, let's not forget that Wagner Group is providing the kind of security expertise and manpower when necessary throughout the Central African Republic, no doubt Congo Brazzaville, and DRC. China, as we've seen, has had problems recently with Angola, but they're still very much invested in exploiting the natural resources of Central Africa, which means, of course, virtual slave labor, complete destruction of natural habitats, of natural forests, which, again, is very lucrative these partnerships with EU-based companies, with American companies, they may be hidden through certain layers of legality, but they're all the same thing. And the people on the ground are being exploited. Their natural resources are being plundered for well beyond below the price of what they're actually valued. Their people are not getting compensated. You have a couple of corrupt officials who are getting the lion's share of any money that's handed over to Congo. And in the meantime, they're getting a security state that's being imposed in areas that would otherwise be incredibly difficult to actually bring that kind of integration. Like, as I've been arguing about Yemen, this war is about forcing Yemen into the global economy, forcing its natural resources, forcing its assets, and to comply with this order, this global order. And many parts of Central Africa have been virtually inaccessible for a long time, not strictly for political, ideological reasons, but just practical reasons, infrastructure. These are very difficult terrains, but now with China being able to gobble up the savings of its working class people who have been trapped in prison cities, and the story we've talked about already before, they've been able to provide the kind of liquidity for these incredibly dubious investments in integrating. Now we have transit lines that literally cut across Central Africa. When I was a young man, I tried to travel through Congo. It took you 12 days, on these incredibly muddy roads, and it was just an impossible enterprise, and it was a very scary enterprise for a number of reasons. And now you can literally take flatbed trucks and drive across from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean. And now you have trains. And so what does that mean? It is not a benefit to humanity. It is not a benefit to Africans. It means that they've been able to find a way to minimize the cost of actually gaining access to Africa's natural resources. God forbid, they've plundered the Middle East. Now they're plundering areas that were not accessible until recently. Same with Yemen. Same with offshore Somalia and Yemen, which share the geological dynamics the same. There's the shame with the fisheries of many countries that were at some point in time actually sovereign states. China has helped implement and introduce these economies into the global economy by way of alliance with an alternative to America and the West. But it's the same thing. It's the same dynamics. The money it gets parked ultimately in the same kind of coffers of that translates in power for the same kind of people. They're helping implementing from digital currencies to police states and capacities to monitor individuals, not only in China or in Russia or in the West, but even in these economies like Kenya, like Congo. People don't operate with the state. They operate with their phone. Everyone has a phone, and which means that they're now buying things with their damn phone, just like the rest of us. That's an integration of hundreds of millions of people who were not part of the global economy 10 years ago. The same argument I'm making about Yemen, the subtitle was, what is it telling about us about the larger world? And the world is basically, thanks to China and Russia, as this marketed alternative, is actually gaining access in a less conflictual way than it would have been required if it was Chevron with American Marines following the economic hitmen that used to play this game. China is now servicing that role. And it's an important thing for us to understand, because we are faced with our alternative media celebrating their operations, celebrating their so-called successes. I don't think they're being duped, though. That's the problem. I've come to the conclusion that they're just simply corrupted. They're reliant on money coming from Beijing or from elsewhere, and they're simply servicing as spokespersons for these enterprises, because there is media on the ground that's very sophisticated and sees what this all is about. The Yemenis have made it very clear. We do not accept this narrative. Iran doesn't speak on our behalf. Saudi Arabia is our enemy, and we are not going to stand quiet to this process. And I'm sure elements within Hezbollah and elements within the Syrian National Army who have been fighting the life, this is a death struggle for them. They've seen sacrifices that you cannot believe. And now to have Bashar al-Assad go and make an agreement with the country that made an agreement with Israel that's bombing Syria every day, there's some really, really, really upset people. And that could translate into what actually empire is looking for in a cheap way, right? Instability in these last pockets of resistance. And Russia, again, helped integrate Syria that was otherwise could have potentially gone in many different directions. And Russia basically stabilized Syria to make it a manageable arena of chaos, chaos that is manageable. So that's also something that I think China plays an important role in, that they come in and mat out what is otherwise a very difficult and possibly very costly struggle that could take years and can go in directions that nobody knows with. Working with China, they have been able to suppress and help. There should be global solidarity for the people of Palestine, for the people of Yemen. But lo and behold, China and Russia, Putin's Russia, they have good relations with Netanyahu, they have good relations with the Americans, good relations with the global market. They are providing the liquidity when necessary. They're providing the raw materials that the global markets need. Russia is supplying China, which is, again, the factory of the world at this stage, or factory for empire at least, with cheap oil and gas. China is providing the kind of diplomatic interventions that are necessary in order to make sure that Iran's natural resources are, in a politically expedient way and in a less costly way, also integrated to the global economy. I don't see any resistance from the Iranian political elite at this stage. I mean, they buy into this whole narrative, or they've been told they better buy into this narrative. But I'm pretty sure that there's, in the inner circles of those who've been fighting and sacrificed so much, this is an outrage. And this can have consequences. We may have coups in these regimes, just like we saw inside Yemen in 2010, 2011, or in Egypt, or in Tunis. And the whole point here is to make sure that these coups don't translate into contingencies that are at the detriment of the interest of empire as a collective or individual actors who are partners with empire or who are tools of empire. And that applies to the entirety of Africa, which is, again, in many cases, still an open question. I mean, you need a lot of manpower to occupy these areas. It's much better if you integrate these areas with the compliance, subservient working population who work under these warlords that are very cheap to maintain. All you need is to give them, you know, a truck full of money occasionally and give them some of the spoils of whatever they're extracting from the earth, and that's enough. And that's what they've created out of the Middle East. No longer strong states. You just have warlords who are controlling large parts of Libya or what used to be sovereign Syrian land and parts of Yemen where the oil and gas is. And when necessary, you have American bases, as we see now in Yemen, very openly. American troops are engaging local population who are resisting. American troops are shooting at fishermen in Mahra province. They're in Shabwa. One of their soldiers was just killed the other day. I'm pretty sure no one in American media has discussed this. And this is kind of mission creep in the old Cold War kind of narrative. But I mean, the Americans have been implicated in the war from day one. That's been quite clear. And now they're working, ironically enough, in an indirect way with Iran and other so-called elements of resistance to empire to really put Ansarullah into a corner. Ansarullah is going to be blamed now for any violence in the future. And they're going to be then have to face the gauntlet of a combined coalition, which could even, ironically enough, include Iranian assistance in helping bring peace to Yemen. I mean, the idea that Iran and Saudi Arabia would work together to bring peace to Yemen is an outrage. And this is not going to
be preposterous.
It's preposterous. It's disgusting. It is. I'm disgusted listening to some of those people who were in solidarity with me and embraced my narrative and certainly were showing solidarity to Yemeni people and peoples of the larger world in general. And the fact that they would fall for this is just, where is your head? I guess people are just desperate for a hero or something. I don't know. The heroes are Ansarullah and Hezbollah.
Absolutely. And yes, that's what it is. It's this desperate grasping for a hero. And the logic is, well, everything's going to be all right. It's going to take some time, but everything's going to be all right. No, it's not going to work out that way. Look at the dynamics, look at the history. It's right there on the face of it. Just to note real quickly before we wrap up, it was SVB that was downgraded on March 10th by Moody's, contributing to the collapse of that bank. So, Issa, I feel like there's so much more we can talk about with regard to this conversation we've been having, and I think it's important for us to pick up on it going forward. I don't think this is the end of it. So let's definitely pencil that in for our future conversations. But for now, thank you very much for joining me from Hungary and for sharing your insights. Always appreciated. And I look forward to our next conversation next week.
Thank you so much for giving me this platform to talk with you, Jesse. Have a great week. Best to your audience.
Absolutely. You too. And that's it for me, everybody. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Joe Hoff is up next here on TNT Radio.